Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing New Zealand author Helen Lowe. Welcome to the podcast, Helen.
Thanks, Sean.
Now, you're a poet, a short story writer in both literary and genre forms, an award-winning young adult novelist, and you're embarking on book two of a four-volume epic fantasy for adults. Is this symptomatic of your love of the various forms, or is it just what's required to make a living from writing?
It's a bit of both, I think. I have always loved both prose and poetry, and so I've always written them from quite both forms from quite a young age. I probably was never so much into short fiction, though, so I think my foray into that would be connected to the thought that, you know, you have to get some runs on the board when you're writing a novel and you're looking to get published for the first time. People do look to see what you've done. So although I had had the poetry interest right through, I thought having a diversity in the prose area would be good.
Okay. I was just looking. Your novel, The Air of Night, which is the first in that series, gained favourable comparisons to Trudy Canavan, Karen Miller and Brent Weeks. What works of fantasy or otherwise form part of your formative development as a writer?
Well, I think if you look at what I was reading as a young writer, authors like obviously C.S. Lewis, Alan Garner, I always liked a lot, and sorry, I just had a complete mental blank. I was trying to say Ursula Le Guin, and for some reason the words wouldn't come out. Ursula Le Guin, I think, in that area, and then, you know, I'm talking about the Earthsea books, and then as I move more into a teen, authors like McKinley and McKillop, Robin McKinley, Patricia McKillop appealed, but as a teen I also read quite voraciously, so I was reading adult books. So I was reading The Lord of the Rings, Dune. I liked David Gemmell's books, Legend, certainly his early books, Legend, Waylander, those books, and also started to get more into sci-fi as I came out of my teens. Ursula Le Guin again, The Left Hand of Darkness is a big favourite. Authors like Joan Voigt with The Snow Queen, but I was also reading Heinlein and C.J. Chera, all those authors. So, you know, quite a spread of authors, I guess.
Yeah, I have a vivid memory of discovering David Gemmell, and I think he must have relaunched heroic fantasy in, was it mid-'80s, early 90s?
When I was reading the books, they've been out there for a little while, but not terribly long, I don't think. Because I read Waylander first, not Legend, although I think Legend was the first book. And then, of course, I was hooked on them. So I remember finding Legend and The King Beyond the Gate quite soon after that. So they must already have been out there, I think.
Yeah, no, certainly. I think probably he and Raymond Feist were my two big formative novels.
Yeah, I didn't mention Raymond Feist, mainly because I think my favourite of his stories, not that I dislike the other ones in any way, but my favourite is the one he did with Jenny Wirtz, the Mara of the Acoma books.
Yeah.
I love that trilogy. I think for both authors, that's actually my favourite of both their works, the one they did together.
I'm going to slide into something that you may have been asked over and over again, being from New Zealand. But obviously you're aware of Lord of the Rings. And we've also had Martin's Game of Thrones grace the small screen, not to mention the Harry Potter phenomenon. Do you think this is the golden age of fantasy?
I don't know that I would agree with that. I think fantasy has just found its way successfully onto the screen. I certainly think that The Lord of the Rings is one of the few fantasy movies that I think is really well done. But I think that the in terms of storytelling, you can look to that period of the 70s and 80s. There were just so many writers and such an amazing sort of array of books really coming out of it. So at one end, at the early 80s, late 70s, you have like C.J. Cherryh with Down Below Station and Joan Voigt with that book, The Snow Queen, that I was talking about. I used to have Heinlein writing some of his big books still in that era. And then you come through sort of to the late 80s, mid 90s, and that's when you get the Robert Jordans, the George R.R. Martins, the Stephen Erickson's all starting to write their big series. And consistently through that period, you also have writers like Patricia McKillop, you know, with her that series, the Riddle Master of Head series, which I really love. Robin McKinley's writing The Hero and the Crown, so you're getting more into that YA. You also have like Gabrielle Kay with his books, you know, books like Diana, which I really like. So I kind of think that in terms of the actual storytelling, that was quite a, there was a lot of really good books coming out then. I didn't mention Barbara Hambly was another author from that mid-80s era, I think, that I really enjoyed.
So in that sense, perhaps the movies are just sort of starting to catch up with, you know, what was going on about 10, 15 years earlier in terms of, you know, what's liked, what's successful and what people really want to see.
I think what it's doing is it's bringing it more into the mainstream. And I think you can point to Harry Potter for that as well, because what Harry Potter did was bring fantasy into the mainstream, and kids who've grown up on Harry Potter who may not have read The Lord of the Rings, for example, but they've seen the movies, and they may not have read George R.R. Martin either, but they've seen the TV show and now they're starting to read the books. So I think that there's a bit of a shift going on there. It just remains to be seen, I guess, what happens with that.
Okay, on still on Lord of the Rings, and I promise it's the last question. In terms of Lord of the Rings and New Zealand, how much of having the movies there has been a boon to local fantasy writers, perhaps raising awareness of the genre, adding extra motivation?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, because a lot of the fantasy writers I know don't seem to have had much of a connection with the movie. The one exception would be Mary Victoria, who, of course, was a digital animator for Weta when the films were being made, and I think digitally animated that famous Gollum fish scene. But other than Mary, most of the authors I know weren't really involved with the movie. I think it's certainly given it more respectability, the genre more respectability. But a lot of the authors that I meet are either writing, say, in Spec 15Z. You know, some of them are doing the paranormal books, the vampire books. But other than that, there's sort of a mix of dystopia, horror, and, you know, more straight-out sci-fi. Steampunk's popular again. So, yeah, no, I think it's hard to pin what's happening with genre writing in New Zealand to Lord of the Rings, other than perhaps it's just encouraged us all to come out of the closet.
Fair enough. So I attended the Adelaide Writers Festival, and I could, in a couple of talks that I listened to, I could quite clearly see where I hate to use the word normal literary scene, but the literary scene was having trouble sort of dialoguing with fantasy. There was one of the ABC's interviewers didn't seem to have the vocabulary to talk about fantasy in I suppose in a critical way. And I was just wondering, yeah, that's just where I'm coming from with that question, is whether or not I suppose that the literature scene seeing this fantasy genre as something worth engaging with, worth talking about, that they see some value. It's not just fairies and goblins and children's stories.
I don't know, you know. That's an interesting one, because I think that in terms of kids' YA, there's been a big shift because of Harry Potter. And there's a lot of writers, established authors, who are writing sort of more speculative stories now. And I know that in the Hagley Writers' School in Christchurch, they're finding a lot of students coming through who are wanting to write speculative fiction, and a lot of them, I believe, are interested in YA. But in the mainstream for adult fiction, I think it's still not particularly respectable as a genre. And, you know, I don't think that's a valid point of view. I think that it just reflects that a lot of the people who hold those points of view don't know or read very widely in the genre, but I think it's still a reality. So when I completed my first manuscript and showed it to the first professional reader, the feedback I got was very much that, don't even bother trying to get published in New Zealand with this. You'll have to go overseas.
Okay.
So, and I've had feedback from other people. That was quite a few years ago now. That would have been about 7 or 8 years ago. But the feedback I've had more recently from people is they're still getting similar messages. I don't know why that is, yeah.
That's interesting, considering what's sort of happening in terms of self-publishing and publishing houses. I think, I don't know if it was Hachette this weekend, opened up to manuscripts, sort of open season, send us your works. But I don't know if that was more just any sort of genre or
Well, in New Zealand, you still can direct submit to most publishers. So that was that Hachette in Australia, was it? Or
I'd have to go back and check my Twitter feed, but I just saw a link to a page where yes, they were saying, yep, send us your submissions. So
okay. Yeah, no, they must have opening it up. But I hadn't actually heard anything particular about that. I believe Voyages in Australia has got a site where you can submit unpublished manuscripts, and there's discussion around that from the people who submit, but also they will occasionally pick one up out of that from that forum. But I don't really know a lot about it other than that.
There seems to be a little bit of talk about. I know there's been some American fantasy authors that have had, you know, 6-book series that they've self-published, and then it might have actually been Orbit in the US. I can't think. Michael O'Sullivan, I think, is the name, but I don't have it up.
The Ruria books, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I believe he was originally. And you do hear in all the genres, like, you know, people have self-published and been successful, and then, you know, I guess because they've got an established readership and, you know, their work, they've proven their work by that means, they do get picked up by a mainstream publisher. Which is probably not that different from, like, people who initially get published by a small press, and if the book does well, they then go on to be published by a bigger publisher. So you get Paolo Bacigalupi, for example. I think The Wind-Up Girl was published by Nightshade originally, and but his YA books are with Orbit, and Orbit's published Wind-Up Girl in UK, Australia, and New Zealand. So, yeah, it's a... It's just all part of the journey, I guess.
Now, I got your book in the mail yesterday.
Okay.
Your second book.
Yep.
Now that you have about 5. And I've noticed that there's a really, really touching dedication in the front of it. And I had actually written this question prior to seeing that dedication. We've all heard about the Christchurch earthquakes, and I certainly was glued to the television watching in dismay when it happened.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, a tragedy of that scale, how did that affect your writing personally, and indeed sort of the wider writing family of New Zealand?
Well, and to start with me personally, I think there's two parts of that question. The first one is that I was writing, from September, if you go back to September the 4th, which was basically around the time of WorldCon, it was during WorldCon, the first earthquake, which did quite a lot of damage, but there was no loss of life. Well, I was writing, finishing The Gathering of the Lost at that time, and I was still working on it in revising it in February when the really devastating earthquake hit. And I think, you know, it was a very interesting process trying to finish a book in that environment, which is basically everything is broken. Everything is not working. People have died, and the, you know, the whole heart of the city is closed off because, you know, so much of it has come down. You know, just that whole thing, and even in neighbourhoods, you know, the suburban neighbourhood I live on, which is on the borders of the east side of the city, which was one of the worst affected areas, if not the worst affected areas, you know, there was that liquefaction. It was just everywhere. We had it really badly, and so did a lot of other people we knew. So there was stuff going on at every level, and so trying to finish a book in that environment was... Yeah, it was interesting. And I think, though, in terms of direct effects on my writing, my feeling is that I don't know, think I'll know for quite some time how much of an effect it's really had, because I think the idea of The Gathering of the Lost was, like, really well established, you know, at that time. And I think it's sometimes it can take quite a long time for effects of things to kind of work through. In terms of the writing community in New Zealand, it's been interesting, I think, because there have been projects like Tales for Canterbury, which was a short story collection put together by Anna Caro of Random Static and Cassie Hart. They were the editors. As a fundraiser, and a lot of New Zealand authors, including several of us from Christchurch, but also overseas authors like Neil Gaiman and Juliet Marillia, amongst others, you know, contributed to that book. So that, I guess, is a direct result of the earthquake. A lot of people wrote earthquake poems, a lot of them people from outside of Christchurch. I know that sometimes people inside of Christchurch have some trouble with people writing about the earthquakes who aren't here. But then, yeah, you know, you get writers like, for example, my fellow spec fic author, Tim Jones. He wrote a poem, which I think is a really great poem. He's talking about, you know, the fact that he had family and people here and his experience of being in Wellington and not knowing and seeing all the stuff on the TV. And I think, you know, that is as valid a part of the earthquake experience as the experience of people like myself who are living here. So, yeah, I think it's, I actually think it's going to take a long time to work through. And I think there'll be the immediate stories, which people kind of outpour. And then there'll be some of the longer term effects, not just of the disaster of, you know, the people who died and some of the terrible things that happened on February 22nd, but the long term aftermath of, you know, of living in a broken city, and it's going to be broken for a long time. And a lot of us, you know, live in houses that, you know, aren't, you know, are going to need major repairs as well. So there's that ongoing process. So, yeah, it's kind of a watch the space, I guess. In terms of the dedication, I just felt like it was such a major thing, and I felt it was really important to acknowledge that writing the book was part of that. But also in the acknowledgements at the back of the book, I actually try to refer by name to a lot of people who helped me personally, either with the... you know, when the liquefaction was really bad, but also things like to finish my edit of the book, being given a stint in Wellington in a house where I could just, you know, and live in a normal environment and just, you know, concentrate on finishing the book. So there's a whole raft of, you know, effects around the book that, you know, a huge number of people helped with, which was great.
No, I'm certainly looking forward to reading it. You've got some lovely jacket quotes from Robin Hobb.
Yes.
Who's another favourite of mine.
Yep. Yeah, I love him. Books.
Yes.
Well, actually, I like most of her books, but that Live Ship trilogy is a real favourite of mine. So.
So that was a nice little surprise for you, was it, that getting that quote?
Yes, it was. To be honest, that quote was originally for The Air of Night, and they've reused it for this book. The quotes that are specifically for The Gathering of the Lost are from Juliet Marillia, which is on the cover of the American book. And also from Catherine Asaro as well, have both given specific quotes. And I think in the US they use the quote from the Library Journal review as well that came through for air. About reinvigorating the epic fantasy, to which I said thank you very much. As you do, I like that. I like that review quite a lot.
No, that's good. I was just going to say it's. I mean, I understand the reason for them, but it certainly would if I just walked in and looked it on the shelf. Being a Robin Hobb fan, I would have snapped it up like that for exactly that reason. It gets very hard to find that author or something like that author that you really love. So
it was a tremendous when she gave me that quote originally, it was just like a tremendous thrill, because here, from my point of view, I mean, this was my first major adult fantasy coming out, and he was a writer I really admire who didn't know me, you know, at all, this writer in New Zealand whom no one's ever heard of. Yeah, and had actually read my book and really liked it enough to write a really great quote for it. You know, she liked the strangeness of the magic as well as the world and, you know, the storytelling. And, yeah, it just blew me away, actually. Then to have writers of the caliber of Juliet Marillia and Catherine Asaro, you know, who's a Nebula Award-winning author, you know, to come through and sort of endorse that original opinion is also very encouraging.
I'll change tack now and talk a little bit about social media.
Yes.
Now, writing has been viewed, whether this is accurate or not, as a solitary profession or vocation. And now authors are expected to have a web presence, in air quotes there, to run blog tours. What pitfalls or pleasures have you encountered with the advent of social media or your usage of it?
Well, I think it's like everything. It's kind of a double-edged sword. I actually think that writing, the process to write and write well, you need no distractions. And the internet is the ultimate distraction. So every moment as a writer that you're on your blog, on the internet, on Twitter or Facebook or whatever it is taking away from your writing, in my opinion. But the other side of that is that, yes, the most important thing is to write the books so people can read them. But I am in New Zealand. It is not easy for me to go to America or the US or even, you know, Australia is the most easy place to get to, but it still, you know, costs money and time and all those things. And so I think the internet is a great way of engaging with people about your work and having the opportunity to put it in front of people, but not just directly to put your work in front of people. Because a lot of what I write on my blog is not directly about my work, it's about genre. And I've also been privileged to do a number of guest posts on SF Signal over the last year, and they have all been, you know, until they're posting a launch post for me tonight, but all the other posts have been about my love of genre and not specifically about my writing. But I guess it's all a way of reaching out to people and say, saying, hey, this is something that I love. This is something that I'm interested in. I actually know a little bit about it. I also write, and, you know, an opportunity for people to think, well, you know, if she's got something interesting to say, hopefully, possibly her books may be of some interest as well. So I think for someone like me, it is really important. And so it just becomes a constant juggling act of the time you need to write the books and write them well and get them out there, but also being able to engage with the community.
I certainly can appreciate the being distracted by the internet. I've just read another post this morning by an Australian author who's said pretty much the same thing. You've got to be able to disconnect from everything so you can get the writing done. Yeah, I certainly find that that the social media, for me, being an isolated writer or commentator, sort of physically isolated out in the bush, that I can discover probably more writers' personalities and the way they think, and then that leads me onto their books. And I and in listening to podcasts as well, I'm thinking Cood Street and the Galactic Suburbia podcast. They tend to talk about books, to talk about authors, and then just having that knowledge of those people, that constant reminder that those people are out there, you know, those books are at the forefront of your mind. So, when you've got the plethora of books there on the shelf or on the website that either Amazon keeps recommending to you, you've got sort of recognition before you even get to looking at covers of books. So that's a big bonus for me from that side of things.
I think the other aspect of the double-edged sword with the internet is because when you are a writer, you are often spend a lot of time on your own, and it's, although that solitariness can be necessary to produce the work, sometimes there's always the risk that you can eat your own liver at the same time. And I think that the siren lure of the internet is the lure of community. And you may find this yourself, like out there in the bush. It's like if you're on Twitter or on the blog, you're actually connecting with people. It's a form of social contact. And I think that's why a lot, quite aside from expectations that writers will promote their work and themselves and all the rest of it, I think that's part of the lure is just the connection to community. Although actually that's another, just to that thing about writers promoting themselves, it's actually a form of commodification. It's like it's just not enough to write. You know, the implication is that it's not enough to write a good book anymore, that you're not just selling the book, but you're selling the author as well.
Yeah.
And I actually have some problems with that because I think I'm not my books. You know, the stories are stories. The characters are characters and I'm someone else. And I think it's like when you love a TV show and you love a character on the TV show and someone then says, oh, well, let's go to Armageddon because we'll meet this character. And I always go, well, no, actually, you won't meet the character. You'll meet an actor who played the character, but it's not the same thing. And what I'm into is the character myself, not the actor. So for me, I guess with stories and books, I think, well, the book is not me. So you will never, when you're meeting me, you're not meeting Malian or you're not meeting Callan or anything like that, the characters from my story. So it's an interesting dichotomy, I guess.
Oh, actually, it sounds, what you said resonates with me. I don't think I've quite thought of it as that way before. I mean, obviously, being isolated, I don't tend to go to too many fan events, but I have been to Supernova and seen, you know, the lines that are so long for certain authors, you know, and you just think, I don't know if I could stand in line for 3 hours to get a book signed. But you know, that obviously have just fallen in love with the character. So, but again, I could be just becoming a grumpy old man too.
And then I think the other thing is that with the, at least for the book, as opposed to an actor. And these with the book, you're meeting the person who's given genesis to the character. So it's, you're sort of a step closer to the thing that you love. Whereas with, I think, an actor, someone, so the character is someone else's creation even, and they've put themselves into it. So you're not meeting the actor and you're not, I'm sorry, you're not meeting the character and you're not really meeting the creator of the character either. But I do think Neal Stephenson's quite interesting, because he absolutely refuses to do any social media or even engagements particularly. I think he may do a few real-time engagements, but not many. And he's pretty much like, well, his business is to get the books done. And it's not about him, it's about the stories. And then you sort of juxtapose that, on the other hand, with people like Neil Gaiman, who very much is the master of social media.
Well, I suppose Neal Stephenson has got the sort of, he's well respected, he's got the niche. I suppose there's no pressure then on him to do that. And if he's not that sort of personality, then I think Joe Conrath is another, the self-publishing guru, is another person that's basically said, I'll do my blog and then I don't have to do anything else because I'm earning enough money that I don't need to, and I really don't like being away from my family and driving around the country for, you know, half a year. So,
and I think it's fair enough, but I guess I think the interesting thing for me is like, and it probably does just come down to personality, but both Neal Stephenson and Neil Gaiman are from a similar era. You know, they've both been going for a while. They're both established even before, you know, had profile even before the internet. Well, not before the internet maybe, but before the whole social media thing took off to the extent that it has. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question for me, because, you know, you do get people who say writing a good book or a good story or whatever isn't enough. But partly I actually think at one level it has to be enough, because if the story isn't good, it doesn't matter, I think, how much of a social media star you are. In the end, if you're a writer, it does come back to the book.
You mentioned, is it Malian, if I pronounced that correctly?
It's Malian, too. You've got to do the Kiwi thing, you realise, and contract five vowels down to 2.5. You know, so every so I was joking with someone a while back, and I said, well, you know, you realise that Azantir becomes Azantir when I say it and all those kind of things. But never mind. Yeah, Malian is how I say it.
Okay, I'm not going to even attempt to try and do a New Zealand accent, because I'll offend probably half the listeners. The Wall of Night series features a strong female protagonist, and women in the series hold positions of power in, I'm going to mispronounce it, but Derai society?
Yeah, no, Derai is right on.
How important do you think that feature is for female readers and even wider, the genre particularly, having a strong female lead character?
Well, I'm not going to try and speak for all female readers, but I will say that for myself, I remember, like, as a young teen, reading books like The Lord of the Rings and Dune, and even though I really, really enjoyed the books and wasn't consciously going all the time like, oh, where are the girls, or where are the, you know, the female characters, when I got to a character like Galadriel and certainly a character like Eowyn, I was just like, wow, this is so cool. And that was my response. And certainly I remember when I first read when Marion Zimmer Bradley's Mists of Avalon came out, and I think when I first read it, it was quite new out, and it was like, wow, this is exactly the kind of story I like, that sort of epic story, King Arthur. And it was sort of before we got into the 1001 retellings of the Arthurian cycle, so it was still a bit fresh then, and it was told from the point of view of the women in the story, and I found that really empowering, because it was like, well, it seemed to be saying that, you know, women's points of view and women's stories actually mattered, and so my connection to those books, you know, it was kind of a significant thing for me. And So, but in writing my books, I don't sit down and think, I'm going to write women characters or I'm going to write men characters. The voices very much come to me. And as they come to me, I tend to write them. So, yes, the Heir of Night story, there are a lot of important women characters doing important things. One of the things I liked, I think it was the SFX review in the UK, and said in a completely matter-of-fact way, you know, we don't get any lengthy justifications of that. And I think, well, yeah, it is fantasy. It's fantasy, so I can write it any way I like. And if I want to write a society where there is that matter-of-fact equality, then, you know, I think I should just do it. And I've enjoyed doing it. And I've never really consciously thought of the whole sex role thing when I've been doing it. Like, I'm not on a mission, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, it's always about the story. I think that if you're on a mission for anything, then that you've got non-fiction to pick that up. Fiction is about the story, but I don't see any reason why women shouldn't do exciting things and powerful things and have adventures and you know, take responsibility. So yeah, I guess that comes through in my stories. But actually, I'm going to say one other thing. Someone said to me, now, I can't remember whether this was actually written in a review or someone just said it, and they said, one of the things I really like about your book is it's full of strong women, but the men aren't weak. You haven't done that by making the men weak. The men are still interesting characters and, you know, sort of, so it's not that. And I felt actually... I really like that. I thought, that's good. That's cool. If that's what comes through.
And I mean, I suppose that's touching on reality, isn't it? You don't have to have equality at the expense of anyone else. It's, you know, giving rights to people is not giving your own rights away.
Yeah, well, I actually think that feminism, to me, is not about being... It's about being for women, if you see what I mean. It's about the advancement of women. But there's nowhere in the contract where it says that women have to be advanced to the detriment of men, if you see what I mean. Maybe some men feel that that's what's happening. But I think that, you know, when you're talking about equality or equity, it's not, it doesn't, it ideally, it's not about taking from one and giving to the other. It's because that's a really limited view of the world. It says that there's only so much pie. And if one person has two-thirds of the pie, then the other person must have a third. And, you know, it's kind of like, and I sort of think with things like equality and that, it's like, you know, emotions like love. I mean, there's actually no limit. So, you know, it's not about taking from one and giving to the other and things like that. So, and I guess another of my philosophies, which I've always had a problem, and I do regard myself as a feminist, but I have a problem with the idea that women are intrinsically better than men. I actually think we're all human beings, and we do get socialized differently and things like that, and that makes men and women tend to behave differently in certain situations, but I certainly think in our inherent human natures, I don't actually think goodness or badness or, you know, superiority, inferiority is actually anything to do with what sex you are.
No, I was going to say that recently been talking about Cordelia Fine's book, Delusions of Gender, which looks at the evidence, and sort of places it, as far as I can tell, I haven't got the book yet, but that differences are socialised differences. So, you know, as you're saying, on a basic level, we're all the same in you know, more similarities than differences, and the differences are born out of, you know, cultural bias, that sort of thing.
I just wanted to say, and I think it's a lot is about power. and in any, you know, whether you look at it sort of as a gender thing or a race thing or cultural in different parts of the world, when people have power, they behave in certain ways, you know, and some of it is, you know, when the balance of power is to one or the other, you know, there's privilege and there's things that go with that. And I think that there is definitely gender privilege in our society, but I don't think that that is directly connected to the essential goodness or otherwise of people's nature dependent on their sex, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. No, I'd tend to agree with that. Mm. Sort of following along on a similar tangent there, I'm not sure if you're aware, but in Australia there's been a focus this year particularly on the treatment of women writers, notably on them being excluded from major literary prize shortlist. Okay. And I just wondered, as a woman writer from New Zealand, what's the situation in New Zealand in regards to either being reviewed or recognised for your writing, and not just you, but other female authors in New Zealand?
Well, I haven't looked at it really closely. I haven't crunched the statistics, but I am aware of the discussion in Australia, and I also know that the same, and I looked at all those figures for reviews and things in the US and UK, and of course the Orange Prize, like the Stella Prize, was started for the same reason, the exclusion of women from a lot of these shortlists. And I think you only have to look at those statistics that came out recently. I forget who did them, but looking at the reviews and the interviews and to see that they're clear, to me it's pretty clear that there is a conscious or unconscious bias going on. But in terms of looking at New Zealand, I mean, if you look at something like the Sir Julius Vogel Awards over the last few years, I think women have been pretty well represented in both the shortlists and the winners. And looking at the New Zealand Post, the list for the Children's Book Awards that came out recently, I think the predominant number of the shortlisted people are women. And then again, if I look at something like the Gemmell Awards, which, you know, The Air of Night has been long listed, or it's a finalist for both the Morningstar and the Legend Awards. But last year I crunched some of the numbers, so to speak, on the it's not been around very long, but I looked at how many women made it into the shortlist, and no women have won it. And a very small number of women are getting onto the shortlist for those awards. So, I mean, it's early days, and it's a reader voted thing. So, I mean, it may be an indicator of reader preference, but yeah, it's interesting.
Coming up to the end of the interview now, yes. And I just wanted to give you a chance. You're launching the Gathering of the Lost. Have you launched it already, or is it this week?
Well, today is release day in Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, and the UK is on the 5th in 9 days' time. But I'm actually having a launch event here in New Zealand as well on the 3rd, Tuesday the 3rd. Is on the writer in residence at the University of Canterbury at the moment. And so the University Bookshop, I'm doing a launch event there. And I'm quite looking forward to that, because I did a launch on my blog, a little bit like what I'm doing today, but I didn't do a launch for The Air of Night because it came out almost immediately after the September 4th earthquake. And as I said, although no people died in that earthquake in 2010, there was an awful lot of infrastructure damage to buildings and very few venues, and you know, everyone was at sixes and sevens, so it just didn't really feel like time to be launching a book. But I guess after 18 months and nearly 10,000 earthquakes, it's kind of like, it's like, well, frack it, I'm having a launch no matter what.
So that's good for your New Zealand listeners.
Yeah.
For your internationals, Australians and people in the US and the UK, we can...
Go into my blog today and on the 5th. So I'm having a bit of a blog party on both those days. Today I'm doing giveaways of books, and there'll be something else for the 5th as well. And I'm over both days, today the 20th and the UK day, I'm running a competition for anyone who comments goes in the draw to give their name to a character in the new book. And I ran that last time, and an SF fans person from New Zealand, Jan Butterworth, was the successful commenter. And so I thought, since it seemed to be quite popular, I would do that again, because it's a nice way of kind of celebrating the books and people's enthusiasm for the books. I'm also doing a blog tour, and I put the details of that on my blog on Monday, and I'll reiterate them, and I'll be tweeting them as I go along. So that starts today as well, the 27th in Australia. I should have a post up at some stage on the Orbit blog, which is looking at the environment of the book. And I'm also doing, very kindly, being invited to do a guest post on SF Signal in the States. And that is talking about celebrating my love of epic fantasy, as well as the launch of the book. And from there, and I think my next gig after that is Trent Jamison in Australia on Friday. So most of my stops on my tour, I think I've one stop in New Zealand so far, and with Mary Victoria, who's a good friend. And then the other stops are mostly in Australia and the USA. So it's all good.
Oh, it sounds like lots for fans to get their teeth stuck into. I'd like to thank you very much for doing the interview. I've had an absolute blast getting to talk to you about all the different things that we've talked about. So, yeah, I'd just like to say thank you and wish you good luck with the launch.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for interviewing me. I've really enjoyed it as well.